I've been doing a series on Central America since last week, and wanted to ask and focus on the question and the subject about what Lutheran involvement is in Central America in this session. And I'm going to break that down into kind of three parts. One, just a brief review of what Lutherans have and are doing there in Central America. And secondly, what is kind of the Lutheran, what has been the Lutheran response or actions and reactions in this country? And then I think maybe more importantly, I'd like to engage in a discussion about what I think is probably the most important thing that we can do, which is what I call justice education in the churches and through the churches in this country. And we have a couple of resources. One is Lois, who is in San Francisco, in worshiping in a community, a congregation which is primarily, it's Spanish-speaking, and primarily, it's bilingual, and serves Central American refugees, or they're not called refugees, they're called illegal aliens, isn't that right?
Both.
Yeah, in this country. John, who is taping this session, has a tape here, videotape here. We're going to try to look at about five, six minutes of that. It's an interview of a Central American and Salvadoran. It was done last year or this year earlier in Wartburg Seminary. And we'll kind of use that as something for us to look at and discuss our reactions to it. So the first of all, the brief overview of what Lutherans have done and are doing in Central America. In one way, not much, historically. The only church of the main denomination of the Lutheran bodies that had mission work in Central America was the Missouri Synod, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And that is the only church that went there with the intention of establishing a Lutheran church. I am not sure when they began their work. It's not a terribly old work, but several decades ago. And put most of the focus on Guatemala, and then in El Salvador. And a little bit has sprung up spontaneously or by the process of the way the church grew there in each country. Well, very little in Costa Rica and Nicaragua, but a little bit of a church, a few congregations in Honduras, a larger church, not a large church, but a very, I think, a very vital church in El Salvador, and a church with more congregations in Guatemala. The church in El Salvador, the Lutheran Synod of El Salvador, in my estimation, is the most vitally involved of all the Lutheran, those Central Americans who call themselves Lutherans, in of any of them. And I think it has to do with some good leadership. And it's a church also that in the last two or three years has come under quite a bit of pressure and persecution. In the last year, one of their pastors, and they don't have very many pastors, but one of their pastors was killed. Circumstances around that are not fully known. Seems to be some mystery about that. But he was a pastor who was involved with refugee and social service work, as well as evangelism and planting and leading church, several congregations and mission points. Pastor Gomez, who I know the best in Salvador, has been really a very significant leader and has been the spark to establish refugee camps, refugee camp work, and a number of services for displaced people. And they have served literally hundreds and hundreds of people through that program. And that has been supported primarily by Lutheran World Relief from this country and Norwegian Church Aid, which of course is Lutheran Church of Norway mostly. And other agencies also have supported that. That Pastor Gomez and one of the doctors, Angel Ibarra, who was a friend of mine and is a friend of mine, were at one time also detained and picked up by a sort of security forces. And I was involved a couple of years ago in a personal way when Dr. Ibarra was detained, and my wife and I got involved very quickly in kind of the phone campaign that went on in this country. It was one of those places where, one of those times, I think, when Lutheran constituency and others in this country really got mobilized and put out cables and phone calls to Washington and down to El Salvador, and I think literally saved their lives. But it was a trauma and a real shock for that small community of Lutheran Christians there. And we from the outside tried to do what we could to give them support. I had the opportunity, a very interesting opportunity, to go there about a month after Dr. Ibarra had been put in the political prison and go to visit him and hear his story. It was a rather amazing story, and he told about the torture that he had undergone when they brought him to a clandestine house. And then after about 2 weeks of this interrogation and some pretty rough treatment, he was put into the political prison, where he was safer than when he was in the clandestine house or in the national police headquarters. So there's been a lot of interaction in the last couple of years around in El Salvador with American Lutherans, and particularly visits to El Salvador by groups that have been organized out of the Center for Global Services and Education. Some of you have heard of that, and I think you went on, did you go on a trip with them to El Salvador and Nicaragua? I don't know. Do you have any idea how many groups have gone to Central America? I think it's something like 25 in the last year, and it's something like 2 a month or something like that. Just a tremendous interest within the churches to going there and seeing and making up their own minds. So that has been a very big program and a big push. We have a lot of support out of the office of the Hunger Appeal, and started actually out of that impetus. Then the bishops of the American Lutheran Church went there, it's almost a year and a half or 2 years ago, and came back and made reflections, or a statement, joint reflections. The packet that's been put out by the ALC is in the, the reserve shelf over here in the library. There's some pretty good materials there and resources if you're interested in what the actions of the Lutheran Church in the United States, or in the ALC particularly, has been. The LCA has not been so active in the terms of the grassroots response. There have been some visits by bishops, there's been some visits by church staff and so forth, but in my, as far as I know, the LCA has been much less active on the congregational level and out at the grassroots. And I'm an LCA Lutheran, and I'm not very happy with that. I don't know. I don't think that's just because you have maybe interest in, at certain levels at the top of the church, that hasn't percolated down. Although I'm sure there are many LCA Lutherans that are very interested in the issues. Edgar Trexler had an editorial opinion in the Lutheran magazine a couple of months ago. I thought it was kind of interesting because he made the point that church views are reliable on Nicaragua. And his point was that Lutheran visitors, bishops and so forth from disparate areas across the country, independently of each other, have gone from Pennsylvania, California, Texas, Iowa, Colorado, have all gone forth hoping to make sense out of the conflicting information from government, from church, humanitarian agencies and so forth. And they independently and consistently seem to come back writing about Nicaragua in the same way. It seemed to him to be a kind of a verification that there wasn't a kind of a collusion amongst people that are going there. They come and they go there and they try to make up their own minds, and they fairly consistently in their reflections after that, and he just enumerates what seems to be their reactions or their opinions after these trips. That, number one, the struggle is not an East-West confrontation, but a populist groundswell against poverty brought on by the decades of at-home dictators and foreign influences. Gains by the Sandinista government in education, healthcare, literacy, land reform, and criminal justice reform outweigh the excesses of the regime and press censorship, political prisoners, and the like. The Contras are not freedom fighters, but terrorists. Nicaraguans want to be left alone to work out their own problems. U.S. policy should support Nicaraguan self-determination rather than strangle its economy. And Soviet and Cuban influence among the citizenry is hard to assess, and probably, doesn't say that here, but in my opinion, not as great as is often shown or indicated or felt to be in our press, in the public press. Well, these kind of views are the intention or the reasons for making trips there, or for the ALC in its convention, its general convention, to make resolutions asking the church members to pray for peace with justice in Central America, to support resolution of the conflict in Central America through non-military means, increased commitment to economic justice and protection of human rights, grant legal asylum to the many Central Americans who have recently immigrated to this country and remain under threat of deportation. The Church Council urges congregations to seek opportunities for ministry with Central Americans. The reason for all of this activity and all of these responses and reactions is that church people and Lutherans, in this case Lutherans, feel that it's important to make statements and to make judgments and to become involved in some way in the issue, which is very much a justice issue, I think. There have been many, not so much among the Lutherans, but many attempts to put out documentaries, film strips, slideshows, and this kind of thing, all with the intention of influencing or to raise the issues for discussion and mobilizing public opinion about Central America in a positive way. Well, I'd be interested in your reactions, assuming that you're people coming from different parts and in the pews, as to how this comes across to you. And what about what we call justice education? And is that a proper thing for the church to be involved in? But maybe first, John, I think he's in that little room back there. We could see this little excerpt on the video, which would show one attempt to tell the story, to tell a story of a Salvadoran through a direct interview using a media technique. And that, let's look at that. Do we need to cover the windows, John?
I think we'll be just for this short thing.
Okay. Just, maybe you want to turn around. Maybe just get, let's watch it for 6 or 7 minutes and see what your reactions are to this, to the credibility of his story, what he's saying, and this as a, it's sort of a second level way of being in touch with Central Americans, where a lot of us aren't in direct touch with Central Americans, but this is trying to put across through a media presentation his particular interpretation.
What was your experience in the church in El Salvador, and what were you doing before you came to this country?
Bueno, yo soy un campesino.
Well, I am a campesino.
Y bueno, he pasado el hambre.
And I've been hungry.
tiempos en que no teníamos ni maíz para comer tortillas.
There was times when we didn't have even corn to make some tortillas.
Y siempre la iglesia estuvo cerca acompañando al pueblo.
But the church has been close to the people, accompanying the people.
Y así empezamos a trabajar organizando cooperativas.
So that was how we began to work, organizing cooperatives.
Para poder sobrevivir en comunidad, porque es la única forma.
So that we could survive in community, because that was the only way.
Y estuve viviendo en la ciudad también.
And I was also living in the city.
Y también ahí se hacía lo mismo.
And there we did the same.
Las comunidades de ahí iban a comprar directamente al campesino.
The communities there would go directly to buy food from the campesinos in the countryside.
Y la iglesia pues ha ayudado mucho al pueblo y lo sigue acompañando en este momento.
The church has helped a lot the people, and they continue to walk with the people.
Y por eso también ha sufrido persecución.
And so that's why the church too has suffered persecution.
Yo creo que gran parte de los que nos hemos venido ha sido así también por estar auxiliando a nuestros hermanos.
I think most of the people that have had to flee El Salvador, most of them have been because we've been wanting to help our neighbors.
La iglesia ha entendido que el pueblo no puede escuchar la palabra de Dios si no ha comido.
The church understands that the people can't listen to the word of God if they haven't eaten.
Entonces por eso se han organizado actividades para recaudar fondos y...
So that's why they've organized activities to raise money and help.
Y también dando protección a refugiados que
han
salido también ahí mismo.
Giving protection to refugees who have been forced to leave.
Monseñor Romero fue el primero en dar el santuario porque en las iglesias, Seminario San José de la Montaña fue el primero en tener.
Bishop Romero was the first one to give sanctuary to the refugees when he opened his doors to refugees in the country.
Yo conocí un lugar en San Antonio Abad donde murió un sacerdote y cuatro jovencitos.
I know a place, a church in a town called San Antonio Abad, where the priest and four young boys were killed.
Pero ellos estaban así organizando, es decir, la iglesia ahí, las comunidades organizaban actividades para sobrevivir.
The church there was organizing and helping the people so that they could survive.
Y también le daba una atención espiritual a los jóvenes que van entrando al estado adolescente.
And they were also giving some kind of spiritual guidance to the young boys, adolescents.
Porque es la época en que por curiosidad puede aprender uno ser drogadicto.
Because it's an age when out of curiosity people can become involved with drugs or
y eso era lo que estaban haciendo cuando llegó la Guardia Nacional.
And so that's what they were doing, was having a spiritual retreat when the National Guard came.
Y al sacerdote le pasaron un tanque.
They ran a big tank, like army tank, over the priest.
Y a los jovencitos también quitaron sus brazos y sus órganos.
Boys, they cut off their arms and their organs.
Pero antes de eso los tiraron al techo y les pusieron armas para sacar el fuego.
But before they did that, they they had put their bodies up on the roof of the building and put arms, weapons in their hands and took pictures to say that they were girls.
Y se llevaron todo lo que tenían en la cooperativa y lo que tenían en una clínica.
And they stole everything that was there and it's cooperative and in the clinic.
Yeah, the mom will love them.
And they also raised the sister of the nun.
Los muchachos yo los conocía, estaban pequeños, todavía jugaban con pelotas de tela.
And he says, I knew the boys, they were just young, they still played like kickball with a cloth ball.
Esto pues indignó a la gente, porque los conocía, eran unos niños casi.
This made the people angry because they knew the boys and they were just young.
Y salió a las calles a marchar en el centro diciendo basta ya, basta ya.
And they went out, the people went out marching in the streets and saying basta ya, that's enough. The stories like that are more the rule in El Salvador today than the exception. Is that right? Que cuentos como esos son muy comunes ahora.
Bueno, hay cuestiones que, hay situaciones que no hay que recordarlas.
There are situations that are just painful to remember.
Por ejemplo, hay gente que le han volado a sus niños y se los han quemado vivos.
And there are some refugees who have had their daughters raped.
What is your reaction to that excerpt there? It's within the context of about a half an hour tape. How do you react to that particular?
I have watched flying since I've been in Twitter. One of our girls, my church, went on it, and she told many of the same things. Like the police coming in and taking somebody, or they were going to, with all the witnesses, they let them go.
Oh, okay.
Then I heard other people say, well, this is, those tours were all staged. It was staged, everything was staged.
Is this the government, the police that are doing this?
Well, it was police that came, and particularly these slides and
stuff. The particular incident he's talking about, I've read about, took place in a church, a pretty well documented Catholic church, and the National Guard came in with a tank and blew those people apart, and it was just some young boys and priests.
And this, our government is supporting now, this particular, as I can never get it quite straight.
Well, very heavily supporting the military assistance to El Salvador, yes. I think the point I wanted to discuss and see what your opinions are is what do we do with this information in the church? What is it that we as Christians, as Lutheran Christians, should be involved in?
I was in El Salvador in January, and Nicaragua and Mexico as well, with Tour mentioned, the Center for Global Service and Education. We asked people that repeatedly, especially in El Salvador and in Nicaragua, and they consistently answered us, go home and tell people, or go home and write to your government. They all seem to have a perception of, they seem to distinguish us from the government. I suppose in large part because Americans who come there are in general sympathetic to them, and they seem to think we can really influence our government. But the biggest thing was just to go home and talk to people, to build awareness. We would always suggest things like, well, how can we donate money? Can we get projects started? And they said, sure, that's fine, that's helpful. But just go home and tell people, build awareness. To take what you see and go home and tell people what you see.
Have you done that? What's your name again?
Bob.
Bob. And how, what has been the reaction when you've told the stories that you, I mean, the information or your impressions?
Well, when I came back, I've spoken about 3 or 4 times to different groups, Rotary clubs and our group and peace and justice groups. A lot of people are sympathetic, are ready to listen to that, because a lot of people who are there are people who are receptive to that. But a lot of the people are
skeptical.
Very skeptical.
Where are you from, Bob? Where were you doing this study?
Around this area, and around the Wenatchee area.
Well, I've heard that often too. This plea to go and educate your own people, tell the story, and this is sort of our approach. At least the organization I work with, we work within the context of projects within the context where social injustice is happening. And so our theory, at least, is that we find stories of people, individuals, and we go back and kind of tell that story to people, and that sort of makes people aware, raises consciousness. It can also be frustrating to know when you get that information what to do with it, you know, on the part of people in the pews. Any other personal reactions to that question about how do you do, or what should we do with that, with information or with our feelings?
Set this up just as El Salvador was having elections, and the U.S. was monitoring those elections, so the U.S. TV networks had cameras down there. So the Sunday of the elections, they put this part, the interview that they had, together with footage that the networks fed them of the voting, and they had a nice little package, and visual and you know, so part of it is knowing how to work with the media. You know, it's confusing for people when they see things on the news and it's conflicted by things that they hear from people like Jerry, or people that hear things they hear from their government. And maybe just adding to the fray and to the confusion. But I guess that's part of my approach. Making it, somehow when things get on television, they have a little more
credibility
sometimes.
Yeah. Was just on your personal reactions, was this a credible to you? Did you believe it? I mean, say your honest reactions, this particular interview.
Yes, but I think our biggest problem is how do we sell this to our churches, because it's either apathy or disbelief that we have to contend with. And how do we approach it?
How do you sell it to the church? And that's what I'd like to...
A study like this in our church, I mean, 92% probably wouldn't show up for that.
What are some concepts or ideas or words that come to mind when you think of, say, the job of justice education, or whatever you want to call it, consciousness raising, or in the church, in your churches, that you want to put across, the concepts? I just name one as an example, justice.
This will be one of our learning communities. Well,
the term I always use is compassion. The Lord tells us to have compassion with our neighbor, so that our Father in heaven will have compassion on us. And compassion means to suffer with, to share with.
Suffering.
How'd you get it across?
Okay. I'm just looking for words or concepts of things that we would like to grapple with. Oppression, and I'm not sure what the difference between repression and oppression is. I never get that straight.
A big one to deal with is just that those people are real, and that they're, you know, if people can get to the point where they really believe that those people exist.
Real people. Are affected.
Human rights.
Human rights. About reconciliation. What else you have to talk about if you're going to talk about these issues in the biblical context or as a Christian?
I guess as I look at that list, it all looks like we're identifying needs that are experienced by the Latin Americans. The words I'd want to slap up there are things like apathy and overconsumption and alienation. I can't imagine any Lutheran in a pew somewhere voting against justice as a concept, or compassion, or suffering, or any of these other things.
You mentioned alienation, and what else? You had another, sorry.
Overconsumption. To me, the real issue is how do you move people from some abstract vote in favor of peace and compassion and justice to really caring, I guess what was said upstairs, about the real people who live too far away for me to really see or feel for them.
I think part of that can come from equating. In other words, educating people to equate. That is a possibility that because... I mean, that's kind of philosophizing, but that can happen to me. What's happening to those people can happen to me. So I feel like to educate them, to realize that, if you want to put it in a biblical phrase, they're but for the grace of God.
Or identify with or something.
Mm-hmm. But to educate people how to identify.
And I guess pushing beyond what you're saying, it's not just that it can happen to me, but the fact that it's happening there, it is happening to me. And I don't know how you educate people in that, but that's where I see it all written down.
Which of these terms are the most emotionally laden? If you raise them in your congregation, you would get people roused up or...
Tell them that they're damn fools.
Huh? It doesn't work.
But I think hurts.
Okay, but which words are the most emotionally laden on this list? Overconsumption?
Yes.
Well, I'm just going to start the ones you think are really kind of...
All of this, who cares?
Alienation.
do they need?
They don't like to hear them.
If you're talking here, human rights is pretty emotionally laden in my experience. Place where I live, peace is a pretty emotionally laden word right now. Because there's a lot of discussion, a lot of opposing views on how to achieve peace. Well then, what are the best ways, if we kind of agree, I don't know if we all agree, but that these are pretty basic concepts or things to deal with in dealing with justice education in the church from a biblical perspective, then these are really basic. Then what are the ways of getting them across? And we've seen one method here, and that's why I asked you, was that a credible method? What are some other methods that you've seen work in your churches or in your experience, personal experience?
Getting people speaking and witness.
Pardon?
People who have witnessed and seen.
Okay.
To come.
We have examples here of people that have been there. I think that's the whole basis of these study tours and other groups that go, or individuals that go there. That's the theory, at least, that they're going to come back and they'll be able to make an impact, kind of a multiplier effect. Does that happen? That's my question. How do you feel after you've spoken 3, 4, half a dozen times? Do you think you've made an, has it had an effect? Or how do you feel about it?
If I feel I had an effect based on people who come up to me afterwards and said how they appreciate it, it's hard to know though. The only responses I tended to get were positive responses. And I didn't know how to view that.
Yeah.
I thought perhaps if people who viewed it negatively might not even.
They might have already left.
Yeah. I think it is a factor. I think it's a real factor. I think it helps promote. I think part of what seems to be the problem is that we need a new image of ourselves. We don't have an image of ourselves as world citizens. We seem to have an image of ourselves as Americans. And somehow the problems of other people aren't quite as important because they're not Americans. I think by getting involved, finding out what's going on other places, and identifying more with it, I think we tend to start caring more because we start identifying them more as brothers and sisters. And I think that's part of our problem, is that the boundaries that we set up as Americans are very strong.
The thing that's amazing about that is, within the group of people we're talking about now, is that we do have supposedly strong identities of ourselves as Christians. And to me, there's a real tension in issues like this between the attitudes that are being portrayed as American and the message that ought to be churning in us of what it means to be Christ-like. That's the tension that maybe needs to be somehow brought out in terms of talking to people in churches. Because the issues on political, economic levels can be enormously complex and confusing. But the issue when it comes down to the things of justice, peace, love, compassion, that's Christ. You know, and that's not a confusing message. That's a very human message. And that's what we're about.
The question I would like to ask you who have done the most in this and know the most about it is, how do you analyze our government's position? Reagan, and of course he's getting Congress to go along with his position. How do you analyze what goals or purposes does the administration have? And what are they found that on? Base on?
What are they founded on?
Base on.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that they base it upon a global worldview.
Fear of communism?
Yeah, it's East and West. Even the Kiesinger by, what do they call it? Not bilateral, bipartisan commission, I think had a strong bias in that direction, because Kiesinger himself understands world power from his experience in other places in the world. And you could have predicted the outcome of the political analysis. Now, they did do some analysis of the causes of the problem because of poverty and a long history of inequality and domination of the masses, say 60 or 80% in each country that are living in subhuman conditions, and saying that that had a lot to do with it. But their conclusion as a result of that was that the Cubans and the Marxists were taking advantage of that, as if the people themselves were not acting in their own history and in their own for their own good, for their own destiny, working out their own destiny, which is something I strongly believe, that I think that the people themselves, large numbers of people, have had enough, they've had it, and therefore they have seen the possibilities when they start organizing, and of course a certain number of them have gone into armed insurrection as a result. But they, in El Salvador, at least for the last 5 years, there has been a lot of support amongst the people for that, for the opposition to the traditional oligarchy and so forth, and it isn't that they have been influenced by a Marxist theory. It's more that they're starting to get some sense of self-dignity and so forth. Whether or not they will achieve that in the near future, I think, is doubtful, because the forces against them now are so tremendously strong. The other thing, I just read that, and I think I knew that before, was that our understanding from our press in this country comes when somebody in the Other Side magazine, there was just an article about the press, and I think that's probably true. They made the claim that 80% of stories and information which has a dateline in some international place in another country originates out of Washington or out of an embassy. And the example that comes to my mind about that is one time when I was going into El Salvador, and I ran into an ABC film crew. So I went over and talked to them, and I said, "What are you fellas doing here?" And he said, "Well, they're starting to talk about El Salvador again in Washington, so we have to come down here." It's in direct relationship. What we get here in the media is there's a direct relationship to the starting to talk about it in Washington. And at the time of the elections 2 years ago, one of the elections, there were 800 foreign journalists in El Salvador. Now, for several months right now, you haven't heard much about it in Central America. And so it can be very skillfully manipulated so that we don't get much information at times, and at other times we get a lot of information.
Well, that was going to be my question to you relative to World Press. You ever read World Press Review?
I've seen that, yeah.
Usually they give several sides, but take somebody like Geyer, the lady you read of her. I was wondering what side is she coming down on right now? Don't you regard her as fairly independent, or don't you?
Well, I don't know if anybody else. You have an opinion, maybe.
Well, I haven't read her that carefully lately, but I thought she was knowledgeable of that area. She often appears on the Washington Weekly Review, but she hasn't been on for quite a while now. You know what other world presses are saying about it?
Well, I know that in throughout Latin America, the opinion in Latin America is almost the opposite of the opinion within the sector in North America.
Would you also say, how about Canadian and UK and Scandinavian and German? Where are they? They're very much like...
I don't know generally about that. I think the Norwegians, as far as I know, are very supportive, for instance, of Nicaragua. There's a high level of interest in Central America and Scandinavia.
Well, Canada is giving asylum to
more so.
Oh, yes. I know in Mexico, in our 6 years there, now you can find leftist Mexico papers, but the big Mexico City papers, the government papers, you don't find much comment about, supportive comment about Nicaragua, because there you have a government that is also shaky, and a government that's pretty scared about what's going on in terms of the country to itself. So you've got lots of political interplays going on. The other thing I was thinking when you talked is not only the U.S. interpretation in terms of world east-west stuff, but I think the U.S.'s own business interests are playing into this a lot. I was appalled recently, within the last 3 months, to see a series of specials on the farm situation in the U.S. And they had some sad interviews with farmers who were being pushed out, et cetera. And then on one occasion they had a big Texas farmer interviewed who had made it, was finding a way to make farming successful in this day and age. And they literally moved cameras following him into a Salvadoran melon plant and crop that he showed this big Texan farmer moving into El Salvador and proclaiming to the world that, you know, this is the way U.S. agricultural interests could make it, by going internationally, using the cheap labor of El Salvador, and the U.S. government was, you know, I just was appalled. And they actually asked the guy, how do you feel about the fact that this country is shooting itself up? And, you know, he just sort of said, well, it's pretty stable to me. They said we do.
Yeah.
I think crimes of people by Penny Lerlong is a pretty good description of American big business interests in Central America. Makes you kind of less than proud of a few Fortune 500 companies.
Tim is mentioning the book Cry of the People by Penny Lerlong, which is kind of a classic on looking at what happens to human rights, particularly in Latin America, a number of Latin American countries, as a result of the interplay between foreign policy and big business and the elites of those countries. Let's not forget that a lot of the fault, a lot of the blame, can also be put on the side of the small elite in some of those countries too, that don't want to change very badly, and they're very happy with U.S. policy. The oligarchy in Salvador and the generals in Guatemala were elated with the first election of Reagan in 1980, because they saw that they were just livid with Carter for his human rights policy.
What about Amnesty International? Whenever there are torture situations, they used to investigate them.
Yeah. Amnesty International is, you know, the respected human rights sort of documentation organization out of London, I think it is. And they do country reports periodically. They've done one in the last year, for instance, on Guatemala. Yeah. And Guatemala always comes out as, you know, the top of the list of human rights violators.
I saw that, but I have not seen it for some. I don't remember the San Salvador.
They have periodic, even special reports on Latin America, and frequently in their publications they update El Salvador. And
the problem I have with things like that is I just get so overwhelmed and depressed. I can't read that stuff after a while. You know, you get saturated.
But I think that's also true in terms of the issue of the people in the pew.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear about South Africa, you hear about Central America, you hear about Timbuktu, and it all is overwhelming, and it's all far away, and, you know, I give my $10 to missions and let somebody else worry about it.
Write a check. Many years ago, I get a talk here, and I guess the only one I have given on Amnesty International, and I told about some of the torture techniques, you know, and I had some people that walked out and they couldn't stand it.
Mm-hmm. I'd make one final comment, unless you have final comments also, is that in this justice education thing, I think we also have to look for ways that people can talk about their own self-interest and our own interests as people. And it is in our interest, I think, as Christians and as people that believe in democracy, that there is equality and justice and democracy and human rights in our neighboring countries. And looking for the connections between people so that for our own spiritual well-being, we need to be concerned and be in solidarity with the people. I mean, it's for our own well-being that we are concerned about this too. It isn't just for completely altruistic. And I can't express that as well as I've seen it written by some theologians, but I really believe that. Anybody have a final question or comment?
The only commenting that I think, when possible, what has got to happen is to listen to the people involved. That's my only concern. It actually came to the fore in our church in San Francisco, where we literally have more than 100 Central American refugees worshiping. And the pastor of our church went down on one of these trips to El Salvador and came back and showed his slides. And it never occurred to him or anybody on the church council to shove the slides and listen to the people that were there. And I think that's my one fear. And it was the first thing I said to Elmer Witt when he invited me up. He said, I'm not the person you need to be listening to. I think it's great that North Americans go down. And if those are the best people we can listen to, fine. But and if it can't be in person, then on video. But hopefully it's not in video instead of listening to the real person next time.
Well, you know, all these one night or one week stands, you don't really, you got to become one of them. Mm-hmm. If you're going to express what's going on. Now the main thing is to get, are the people you interview, you know, the first question someone will ask on that TV series is the person speaking credible? See? And you've got to get credible people telling you the way it is.
And in my experience, North Americans, we will listen much more intently to a Salvadoran who speaks English. Mm-hmm. Going through it, you know, it's really hard to, you lose that sort of link there.
Except it's been very powerful in San Francisco. There's a whole organization that has house meetings and translators who translate for refugees. And yes, some are more effective than others, but it indeed is a powerful experience to be looking at the flesh and blood person who's telling the story, which is something which, here you don't see the face, you're not in the physical presence. It's a real risk for these refugees who are illegal to come into somebody's home and spill their story personally, even through translation. Now, if you're somewhere where that's not possible, understandably, other means are effective. But it just strikes me in San Francisco, there are even those occasions within the congregation I love and work with, where you almost have to walk over the real people to get to the slides taken by the great pastor on his journey. and those things happen, but I think we have to call ourselves.
We're
going to
go through
the open right now. Wait, that's what much of what's been said is that I experienced in the Philippines, and it's very similar. And what's very disappointing to me in my own church, I get more response from other churches than do of my own. And I've shown slide program after slide program in my own church, and they'll come through. Bill, that was nice, they're beautiful pictures. Well, don't mess it, y'all. Get over to them. And I think if we can get people from there to come and speak,
then how do you deal with the ears that are in the community? How do you deal with people's fears that they're going to get?
The refugees' fears?
Yeah.
Well, that is something the refugee deals with. And all I'm saying is there's an organization called CISPAS, which is particularly focused on El Salvador, and others that support Guatemalans, etc. And I'm simply saying that at least in that case, there are those refugees who feel strongly enough about it that they will make themselves present and speak out with great fear, because that does have its networks back in their own governments.
Well, the critical question, of course, is, and I'm asking Jerry and Lois, obviously, you're working at do you still see hope? Is that right? You think there's hope?
I can only respond that the Central Americans have taught me hope. There are many times when I lose hope. What's amazing to me is that there are those individuals like the Marina I spoke about this morning who just blow me away with what they show me as far as trust and confidence and hope. And I just am humbled. And what right have I to be hopeless if people living through the experience feel hope? And it's hope in God. That's the powerful message.
Yeah, well, I guess I get a little overwhelmed and pessimistic about a political solution to the problem as I look at it. Logically, it seems like it's going on. It doesn't seem to be an out. But that's when I make a trip there and I am with the people. And usually I'm with the rural people, and there mostly are poor people or people within the evangelical churches. That's my main circles of that I work with and travel amongst. And I always feel revived and rejuvenated when I come back from those trips, particularly from rural people. And that is, I think I need that. I need that kind of contact. Otherwise, I couldn't keep working in this kind of work. It's just too overwhelming.
Is there a consensus in the church down there on what would help them?
No, there's a lot of varying opinions within the church, but...
Tell the story.
That's another session probably. We should need to know too, but there is a lot from within what they call the sort of the grassroots movements within the church, which is very, very hopeful also, but not necessarily in all cases from the hierarchy of the Catholic Church.